We will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 325, and I will have Mark give us a summary, and then I'd like to have Mr. Delaney come up and explain how the law works, and I think you're going to give examples of how other states deal with this as well. And then we have welcome Representative Morgan and the famous bowler Senator Nelson to the committee. We don't have anybody from too far away. And we're going to have Ken Matlock in video conference, who is the constituent of Senator Nelson's that is the origin of this bill. So go ahead, Mark.
Chair Corcoran, members of the committee, we're considering Senate Bill 325, which removes the limit on the number of hours a retired member may work and still qualify retirement under the public employees retirement system. If the member is employed by a sheriff of a county with a population of fewer than 75,000 inhabitants, or by a municipal police department of a city with a population of fewer than 15,000 inhabitants, or by a state or county for work in correctional institutions located in a county with a population of fewer than 75,000 inhabitants. There is one amendment at this time. The Dash 1 amendment considered this day addresses an issue specific to the Umpqua Community College by removing the limit on the number of hours a retired member who is employed by a community college district as a president or as an interim president may work. And this amendment has a sunset provision, January 1, 2007.
Thank you very much. Welcome, Mr. Delaney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Steve Delaney, legislative liaison for PERS. What I've handed out to the committee is just a brief memo explaining what the current practice, or rather the current statutory provisions are for the reemployment of retirees, so that you'll understand the context of your bill you have in front of you. There are two basic statutes that impact retirees within the state of Oregon. 238-078 allows any retiree to return to full-time employment and become a contributing member once again. So there's always that option to a retiree. 238-082 is the one that deals with limited return to work so that a member can continue to receive the retirement benefit while being employed. Currently, 082 limits such reemployment to 1,039 hours per calendar year. That is important to note because the clock, in essence, re-ups and resets to zero when the next calendar year comes into play. There is also an alternative criteria set out in statute. That is the Social Security benefit limit. If a person is at an age eligible to receive a Social Security benefit, they're given an either-or criteria. They can either reach the 1039 hours, or if the Social Security salary limit would provide more hours, they can work to that limit. Finally, there is the exception that was provided in legislation last session that allows the teachers or administrators in a county of 35,000 inhabitants or less to exceed the 1,039 work full-time and not have their retirement benefits impacted. I have also attached a survey. The survey was actually done by the state of Idaho. They were trying to determine what other states in the western region were doing with regard to the reemployment of retirees, and they've summarized the various states, including Oregon. Bottom line is there are restrictions generally in all the states with regard to reemployed retirees. You'll see that there are different attempts to try to get past that at times. For instance, under Alaska, you notice they had a time period there of, and under the limit on working, they have a time period of July 1, 01 through June 30, 05, where they're allowing people to exceed their limits because they have a need for workers and didn't have sufficient staffing available and therefore had to draw upon the retirees. That's, again, basic statute of what that we're currently working with, as well as a view of what other states do, and I'm available to answer questions you may have regarding that.
I guess it's not so much a question as a comment, or maybe you'd like to comment on it, but we now have come up with, I think, three new categories with the deputy sheriff, the community college administrator. I don't know how broadly or narrowly that language is constructed. And, you know, I haven't even seen, I think it's Senate Bill 9 that Representative Butler was talking about that would allow the waiver in the case of National Guard service.
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 9 was the one that came up yesterday and was in the news dealing with health insurance issues for National Guard, and that did come up. It is true that the National Guard is, or forestry also, is concerned about having emergency workers exceed their 1039 and imperiling their retirements. I'm not sure about Representative Butler's position with that. I do know that on the House side, there's a House bill that Representative Butler has introduced that deals with road assessment districts and allows them, workers for those districts, to exceed the 1039 because it's an area where they're finding a difficulty in obtaining employees in eastern Oregon. With regard to the National Guard folks, it is true that there is not currently any exemption for those individuals under per statute, and if a National Guard were fighting fires in an emergency situation and exceeded the 1039, they would be considered employed and we would have to terminate benefits and restore them to active service.
So we may end up looking at maybe some sort of blanket exception, and Senator Morgan indicated maybe one, or Representative Morgan indicated maybe one even with a sunset for, you know, doing what Alaska did in essence, and given the situation we're now, creating a bunch of exceptions seems like kind of poor planning and probably a bureaucratic nightmare for you guys. So.
The only caution, Mr. Chair, that we've shared, and we shared this one when it came to the teacher and administrators in counties of 35,000 or less in last session, was that it can only apply to those who have reached normal retirement age and after, as opposed to those going out under early retirement age. There is an IRS concern over releasing the limit to anyone who has not reached normal retirement age. And that language was added to the bill last session dealing with the teachers and administrators in counties of 35,000 or less. The current statute indicates that they must have reached normal retirement age.
Oh, so if I, under your option two here, if I list that, that's only under normal retirement age then?
Correct.
Okay. I guess the other point I want to clarify just for the record is that we have a public perception problem here to some degree, in that people that don't understand the recruitment difficulties in rural Oregon have characterized these discussions as double dipping, and there's been examples in the Oregonian, Statesman Journal. I just want to be really clear on the record that double dipping means something completely different to me, because the fact of the matter is these folks are drawing a retirement, but they're actually employed for their other revenue. Double dipping to me is having two retirement plans and not working. I mean, that's maybe it's not something to highlight, but that's how I see that particular issue. Thank you, Mr. Delaney.
Thank you.
Will the honorables please come up? And Senator Nelson? No.
Just one misspent night. In a bowling alley. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is David Nelson. I'm the state senator from District 29, which has four counties, Wallowa, Union, Umatilla, and Marl. And Bill has been brought at the request of one of my constituents, Ken Matlock, who's going to be coming on here in the video shortly. He's involved with law enforcement. And I think the committee is well aware of this issue, and I appreciate your taking the time to hear it. You've, I think, hit upon the notion that this is a system that basically has worked in rural Oregon. In the last legislative session, we passed it for education situations, and talking with one of my ESD superintendents by the name of Ed Schumacher, he said the sole benefit, or the best benefit of this whole thing, is it actually serves the children involved from the education viewpoint, because they're able to have experienced teachers come back, or experienced superintendents that would not be able to work, particularly in these small areas of population that just don't have the access to the people that you might have in an urban area. So, you know, I think that you understand these issues. I'm not going to take any more time talking about that. I think there's some real potential to do some good things. I've had other suggestions say, well, why don't you just do this on a statewide basis in the urban-rural areas, because it maybe could help both areas. put a sunset on it to get us through these difficult times, because this is what really we're concerned about, is we're giving access of service to people. My constituent is in law enforcement. He would like to continue doing that, but and I think he could really bring some good experience and some good service to the people. So that's my position on it. I think it's something worthwhile to look at and leave it to the committee to work the details out and see how it can answer some of the policy issues that the chair has brought forth.
Thanks, Senator. Any questions? Senator Walker?
Just one, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Senator, no one's taking advantage of anyone in this proposal, are they? I think both sides know what's going on.
I think the chair said it quite right. It really isn't a double dipping.
No.
You have a retirement, then you get another job. And then you have this experience, and it allows you to do it. And so I'm in favor of looking at it. And then trying to answer some of the policy questions that may cause some issues.
Thank you.
Senator Minnis?
Question. If they were to hire back a retired police officer under the circumstances, do they pay into PERS?
No. I don't believe the employer or the employee pays into PERS.
All right, so they're not getting an additional retirement pension. Right. They're just getting an hourly wage for the work they perform.
That's correct. And remember, too, that Mr. Delaney pointed out that the fact is that they can't retire early and be eligible under the one exception that we have now for teachers. Okay, thank you. Representative Morgan, welcome.
Thank you, Chair Corcoran. For the record, my name is Susan Morgan. I'm a state representative from House District 2, which is Douglas County and parts of Josephine and Jackson County. And I brought the Dash 1 amendments for your consideration today, and Mr. Ellsworth has already spoken about them. Basically, they are to address an issue at Umpqua Community College, which is a community college that serves Douglas County. And Umpqua Community College is currently in a situation where they had gone through a search and hired a president. That person, for a variety of reasons, didn't turn out to be a match for the task. It was just not a task and talent match. And that person has left and was replaced in a temporary capacity by Harvey Bennett, who was the retired president of Rogue Community College. And Harvey had brought Rogue from its beginnings to the well-run organization that it was before it still is. And he stepped in on an interim basis at Umpqua to run the ship while they were in a search process for a new president. They're in that process right now, and they have gotten in fewer applications than they expected to get in. And they're in the process of kind of sorting them into a pile of people that they want to interview. They will step through the interviews and I think do it in a different way than they did it the first time around. And if they are successful in bringing out of that pool a candidate that they feel is a match for the job, then they'll successfully have a president in place by the time that Dr. Bennett runs out of hours under the 1039 provision of being able to work as a first retiree, which will happen around the middle of the summer. If anything at all goes wrong with the process, then Dr. Bennett will run out of eligible hours and the community college will be without a president. As you know, we have asked the community colleges to do a number of things involving economies on the dollars that we give them because of the financial situation that we're in. And the concern, and I think it's a very justified concern at Umpqua Community College, is that leaving the college without anything running it right now, when there are severe fiscal issues to be dealt with, there's downsizing issues to be dealt with, there's personnel issues to be dealt with, and they have also left a number of their management positions vacant as a cost-saving move. And so I have offered this amendment to try to solve that problem. And what this does is it simply limits the discussion to community college presidents or interim presidents. It puts a sunset on the ability for these people to exceed the 1039 rule of January 1st, 2007, so that in the next session of the legislature, if nothing happens, this goes away, but it gives the legislative session an opportunity to discuss the issue and make an assessment about whether we're still in this kind of, I would call it, emergency phase of Oregon's history here, and there is still a need for this service to be able to continue. But I personally have real concerns about the double dipping issue and the public perception of that. And I think that the sunset is one way to deal with that concern that we're going to have to deal with in the public sector.
I guess, Representative, I have a slightly different take, just in the sense that I could understand. I mean, I don't know if it's a systemic problem of rural Oregon that this recruitment and retention at this time is an issue, rather than, you know, in which case a sunset probably isn't the answer. And I don't know that the sunset would really alleviate, you know, public perception. You know, the public that makes those kind of criticisms are the public that don't see, you know, the benefit of making an adjustment like this. And so, but I think we can work through that, and this will have to wind its way over to the House as well. I think what my intention would be today is to try to go into a work session to move the amendment into the bill, but then hold on to the bill and see if we get these National Guard and other potential exceptions, and then have at least all those in one bill. And between that time, now and then, we can have the policy discussion about whether it makes sense to keep adding exceptions or to make a more generalized kind of open program out of it. So, any questions, Senator Menace?
I'm just wondering if the policy might not be better addressed by allowing the PERS board to deal with these issues on a case-by-case basis. If a municipality or a county has a need, that if they made their request to the PERS board, that they could make the exception, as opposed to the legislature carving out special little nuances each time someone has a peculiar or particular need that comes up. So,
well, they've done such a good job on the mortality tables, we might as well give them something to do, huh?
I was trying to speak positively.
I think that's a fine consideration and one that we should probably pay attention to, and I'll talk to you about it if you think we should.
I don't know if the first board, you know, they have that kind of latitude. I would assume that if you had a city or a county who had a need, and the county commission or the city council brought it to the PERS board, whether or not it would be an onerous responsibility of the board to try to work that through, or maybe it is better suited for the legislature. I don't know.
Would either Mr. Delaney or Mr. Boyko like to take a shot at? Oh, here comes Mr. Well, we can't have two of you at once as a rule. That's a double dipping. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Boyko, welcome.
Thank you, Chair Corker, and members of the committee. I would like Mr. Delaney to keep close by so that I don't stray from the appropriate path. It is, of course, the right of the legislature to delegate this authority if it so chooses to the board, and the board has not taken a position either seeking it or stating as to whether or not it would be easy to do. I think I can say, based on past discussions with the board, that if it were to be delegated to the board, we have a standing request that the criteria, policy criteria for approving or not approving any such request, be extremely explicit in the statute. And I think that would prove difficult. I think that's one of the reasons that you have so many one-off exceptions coming before you, because there's such a diversity of kinds of needs. I would also say, based on looking at the agenda for the PERS board, that the board already hears disability contested cases, as well as contested cases about financial matters. In fact, I believe the upcoming board has 4 or 5 such cases before them. Each one can take anywhere from 15 minutes to 45 minutes. I would also remind the committee that this is a volunteer board, that it meets only once a month, and that it's based on legislation working its way through this body, about to move from 12 members to 5 members. So I think all of those things, in my judgment, would argue some caution about delegating a new, potentially expansive delegation of authority to administer a policy. But again, that is the prerogative of the legislature, if you so wish.
Mr. Chairman, I take back everything I said past hello.
And Mr. Boyko, identify yourself for the record.
I am Jim Boyko. I'm the Executive Director of the Public Employees Retirement System.
And Mr. Boyko, I don't know if you answered the question, I just wasn't paying attention, but part of the question, which is, does the board now have the authority to make such an exception?
I don't believe so, that
okay.
We would not have that authority, that we would have to look directly to the statute and apply it as written.
And you wanted to add to that, Steve?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, perhaps just one piece of history that might help, because maybe moving back to where the statute once was. Up until the mid-70s, each employer had that obligation to determine that there was an emergency and had to document in paperwork to the board that an emergency existed and that they were needing to reemploy a retiree for a given period of time. It was removed in the mid-70s.
That's interesting. You had another comment?
Well, I guess I understand the justification, what the sponsor of the bill wants to do, and that is that there's an inability to hire experienced police officers in certain circumstances. I don't know whether or not the city of Portland or the Multnomah County might likewise have a very similar situation. I know that their recruiting is sometimes very difficult also. The U.S. Marshal, I know, hires a lot of retired police officers and deputy sheriffs under the federal system, kind of a similar kind of circumstance. And I just don't know whether or not this might apply to the city of Portland, too, in some circumstances, and what the justification is for carving it out for, say, small cities or small counties,
mm-hmm.
or if there's a broader justification for doing it. I guess that's all I'm saying.
That's a good point. And actually, you know, when you look at the nursing shortage and the teacher shortage that are demographically driven for the most part, this could crop up.
I mean, if the legislature's choice is to you know, intentionally recruit people to rural parts of Oregon or whatnot, that may be a very, very strong argument. I just don't know what the answer to that would be.
Okay. Thank you very much.
And my apologies, I did not identify myself again. Steve Delaney with Oregon PERS.
We didn't think you had changed your name, Steve. Is the panel okay with moving the amendment in and then just holding on to it till we see what the other...
We need to have Mr. testify.
Right. Oh, no, I want these other folks to testify. But let's. We're going to see some new technology here, folks.
Right now?
Yep.
Oh, no.
This is democratic technology at its best.
I have some help coming.
Okay. So you distinguish between Democratic and Republican?
It doesn't work.
It looks a lot the same.
Okay, 30 seconds.
Okay. Yeah, just pass it out.
Yeah. I'm sure the chair can fill 30 seconds.
Yeah.
Tell us a joke, will you?
Yeah, we've got 30 seconds.
Well, actually, I am writing a column for the Eugene Weekly describing Senator Menace and
my tourism bill, right?
Yeah, he's got this anti-tourism bill that's caused a lot of havoc here in the building. And I was going to say that, you know, we have a lot in common in terms of being, you know, sort of tall, thin guys with a lot of no gray hair, and that the only difference between the two of us is that Senator Menace thinks he's smarter than I am, but I know we're both Irish, so that can't be.
I thought you were going to talk about metal underpants.
Oh, metal pants, yeah. Oh, good.
Metal underwear.
I got a call from my mother on that one. That was a little bit embarrassing.
And rightly so, I think.
Yeah, and rightly so. Okay, we'll hold for a minute for Ken Matlock.
We don't have any resources.
John Powell or Keith Stubblefield, do you want to come up while we're waiting, please?
Sure.
Sure. And I'll just warn you, Mr. Stubblefield, that if we actually get the technology working, we may.
The timing is good, Mr. Chairman. My comments will be brief.
Okay. And before we start, I would like to welcome my good friend Willard from Eugene, who's here visiting. Thank you, Willard.
Good job.
Go ahead, Mr. Stubblefield.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Keith Stubblefield. I am retired, a former state employee. Based upon the schedule, I retired 1999. So.
I'm sorry to do this to you. Guess what? We just got Ken Matlock. So if you can hold on for just a moment, we'll get right to you. Mr. Matlock, welcome. We still don't have some audio problems here. Hang on.
It's a delay. little bit of a delay.
Can you try identifying yourself again, please?
Looks like he can hear us.
Can you hear us? Wave your hand.
Okay. I can hear you.
Okay, we can hear you now. Thank you very much. Welcome to the committee.
Okay, thank you.
Welcome to the
thank
committee.
You.
Yep, please proceed.
Okay, my name is Ken Matlack. I am a retired Oregon State Police Sergeant. I retired out of the Arlington State Police Office in 1999. When I retired, we moved to our hometown of Erigan. Erigan's a small, rural little community located on the Columbia River, just north of the Umatilla Army Depot. When I became involved in the community, I was aware of the fact that Erigan does not have a police department at all. They had one years ago, but due to budget crunches, they lost their police department. Well, because of my interest and my expertise, I was going to volunteer as a city marshal or in other capacity to restart the police department. I came to the realization with the PERS limitation, the 1,039-hour limitation, that was not going to be possible. I wouldn't be able to take on that job, even if I were to do it at a very limited salary, which was my intention. When Representative Jensen had his bill introduced and passed and became law, with the school teachers and administrators working in Eastern Oregon primarily, that was my understanding, with the seven counties, it was a very good thing because what it did, it increased the hiring pool of people. This allowed them to maintain folks that had expertise and experience, which was what they were really needing at the time. Well, from my experience, law enforcement also was in need of an increased hiring pool, especially in Eastern Oregon. I had the occasion to speak with some of the law enforcement folks in Baker County, for instance, where they're trying to start a communication center, a new one. They had their applicants and candidates come forward, and I spoke to one lieutenant who was very disappointed in the quality of the applicants. Most of them did not have any experience or training in law enforcement. I asked them if they had any retired city, county, or state police officers in their community that would be able to do that. And they said, oh, yes, we have the retired folks, but unfortunately we can't take them on because they're limited with the PERS hours. We don't have anyone available that could do that. In my old county, Gillum County, where I was working last, they created a new agency. It's called the Tri-County Communication Center. This includes Wheeler County, Gillum County, and Sherman County. It's a law enforcement dispatching point for those three counties. I'm concerned for them also being able to attract qualified people because of the remoteness of the area. Those three counties are the smallest populated counties in Oregon. They also have some of the most restricted budgets and resources available for their benefit. So in that regard, the problem of locating people that have expertise and experience is very obvious in those small rural counties. My intention with Senate Bill 325 was to eliminate the 1,039-hour limitation. My idea was that the employee would not pay into PERS. PERS would not pay back to the employee any additional benefit other than what he was getting. Another benefit that I thought was very helpful to the small cities and counties was that they would not have to pay the PERS portion of the benefit package. As I understand it now, what a city, county would have to pay would be between 6 and 12% of that salary going back into PERS. So if a city, county, or state entity was hiring in these areas, then they would be saving a substantial amount of money that would be very helpful in this particular time. In regards to labor relations, my intention was that if a person was to be considered for a position and he was looking at it being a union job, well, then he would merely fall under the auspices of the union. He would join the union. If the job was a management position or a management-exempt position, then he would become part of the management team. To me, it looked like it was very much of a win-win situation for everyone, especially the small rural counties and cities. Now, I understand that the bill has been increased on the population from 75,000 for the size of the county and 15,000 for the size of the city. At this particular time, I'm sure that almost all cities and counties in the state is facing restrictions in their budgets and their resources. However, I'm firmly of the belief that in rural Oregon, the smaller towns and counties are much more impacted because they don't have the resources, one. Two, they don't have the hiring pool of people that would be available. If you were able to look at a PERS retiree that you could hire, or enter into an employment contract and not have to pay that additional 6 to 12% in the retirees benefit or the employee benefit package, then that would be a great asset to these small cities and counties and would make it a very viable option. Looking at the TV, it looks like I can see a picture of me, but I don't see a picture of you folks, so I don't even know if you're hearing me right now.
We're hearing you, and you're not missing much. I appreciate your testimony, and let me see if the panel has any questions for you, Mr. Matlock, and how's the weather out there?
It's real windy today.
Okay, good. Any questions from the panel? We had a very good explanation from Senator Nelson and from Representative Morgan, who also has an issue with this. So what we intend to do, just for your information, Mr. Matlock, is try to hold on to the bill until we see if there's other exceptions like National Guard positions and some other public safety positions, and then we'll try to move forward with it. Oh, Senator Menace has a
question. Appreciate that.
Senator Menace has a question for you.
Mr. Matlock, when you retired from the state police, how many of your colleagues who retired with you left the state of Oregon for Texas or Washington or some state that did not tax your benefits?
Several people that I remembered retired about the time that I did. For whatever reason, they left Oregon. I don't have any numbers to tell you how many people stayed in Oregon, but they're all over the country, different places.
All right, thank you.
Okay, I think that's it. Mr. Matlock, we really appreciate your cooperation and helping us out with this, and it was nice to see this distance video. I've done this with a school venue before. It's a very interesting experiment.
Thank you for the opportunity.
And you got the best of the deal because you didn't have to see us.
Mr. Chairman. Go ahead, Senator. Very definitely democratic technology because it's a little bit slow and the time's delayed. So
you don't need to hear any of the rest of this, Mr. Matlock. Thank you very much. Okay. Now we will return to Keith Stubblefield. Thank you very much for your indulgence, Mr. Stubblefield.
Well, Mr. Chairman, thank you very much for the opportunity to be here. My comments, I hope you have a copy of my comments. They're brief. And a point that I wanted to make, based on my experience in the criminal justice community in terms of planning, coordination, and so on over the past several years, is that it is often difficult for departments in the smaller, fewer populated jurisdictions to retain public safety personnel. And that's simply because, as I've seen too frequently, the employee is trained at the cost of the city or county, and then they gain the initial experience in these smaller departments. And too frequently, they move to the larger jurisdictions. We see them in Beaverton and Portland and Eugene, etc. If the counties and municipalities with these smaller populations can employ retired officers, the retired officer can then help provide more assurance of safety, public safety, for the citizens of Oregon's community in these smaller areas. And I've watched this over the years, and I've seen it as a real problem. Now, with the fiscal constraints we face and the other problems in terms of budgetary issues, I feel that this is the kind of issue that would be very appropriate for the committee to move ahead on. And thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Stubblefield. Any questions, folks? Seeing none, thank you very much. And Mr. Powell from the Oregon State Sheriff's Association.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I'm John Powell, representing the Oregon State Sheriff's Association, and Kevin Campbell asked me to speak on behalf of the Chiefs of Police as well. Mr. Chairman and members, we would support Senate Bill 325. However, we would recommend, as some of the previous witnesses have, that the population limitations be removed and perhaps a sunset put on the bill. And the reason for that, as was indicated earlier, the budget crunch is affecting all of local government. If you have somebody retiring in law enforcement, it means that you have to train them and get them up and running with both official training and additional training with their responsibilities. We believe that without the additional PERS requirement and payment, people will work for less, and you can, in situations where counties or cities are losing one, two, three, or four deputies due to budget cuts, you will get one or two of those back under the system. So we think it would be a very positive step for local law enforcement if you would allow it for at least a five-year experiment.
Thank you. Senator Walker?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Powell, the sunset provision you want to leave on there because you think we should just do that as sort of an experiment and see how it goes and whether it's appropriate to continue?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Walker, again, the sunset concept was just talked about from several of us or came up in the discussion with several of us because we felt that the legislature would probably want to do it that way. It's not something we would demand, obviously, in order to support, but we thought that there would likely want to be a look back at this policy at some point.
Okay.
Please don't bring up the word look back. Senator Minnis, did you have any questions?
No, I do not.
Okay.
Senator?
Just note that that's two words.
Very good.
I've been reading a lot about look back, and it has become one word with interest. Thank you very much.
Hyphenated word.
Okay, I'm going to close the public. Is there anybody else wishing to testify? We've got the list done here. All right. I'm going to close the public hearing, open a work session on Senate Bill 325. Senator Minnis?
Move the adoption of the Dash 1 Amendment.
Senator Minnis moves adoption of the Dash 1 Amendments. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. And we will close. We'll hold on to this, folks. Close work session on Senate Bill 325. And we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill. I'm going to open a public hearing. I don't have to tap three times, do if I'm doing all three bills. Public hearing on Senate Bill 444, 445, and 446, please. And Mark, would you please explain what those bills do?
Chair Corcoran, members of the committee, Senate Bills 444, 445, and 446 modify criteria used by arbitrators in public collective bargaining and cover issues in 445 on the definition of a supervisory employee, and 446 modifies the definition of employment relations as a subject for negotiation to include staffing levels and safety concerns as they interact with each other. There are Dash 1 amendments for each of these three bills.
Okay, thank you very much. I believe we have the same suspects on the witness list for all three of these bills, so I think what I would like to do is call up the proponents first, and then we can have the folks who are here against the measure to speak. And so let's have Mr. Livingston and Mr. Tedesco, please. Boy, I'm glad this wasn't an emergency.
Oh, my goodness.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Livingston. I represent the Oregon State Firefighters, and to my right is Mike Tedesco, who represents many of our fire bargaining units as well as many police bargaining units. I'm going to briefly just give you an overview quickly of our view with respect to all three of these proposals that are in front of you, and then turn it over for Mr. Tedesco, if that would be okay with the chair, and then be happy to take any questions after that.
Great.
I would like to appreciate you, Mr. Chair, as well as all of the committee members for allowing us to talk to you about these issues. I think I'll simply start with Senate Bill 444. Senate Bill 444 has to do with the criteria with respect to interest arbitrators, and just for the edification of the committee, interest arbitrators are simply people that are strike-barred employees. And Senate Bill 444 is what I would refer to as a modest change in current criteria. As some of you are aware of, in 1995, Senate Bill 750 made some huge sweeping reforms with respect to the Public Employees Collective Bargaining Act, and Senate Bill 444 would simply modify the criteria with respect to how it treats interest arbitrators. And what it would do is it would give more definitive information to an arbitrator as far as what criteria they can look at when they make an award. Clearly, I think that in last week you had some angst, certainly from our employers, with respect to their concern with what defines interest and welfare of the public, and all that this bill would simply do is add some more clarification as to what an arbitrator should be reviewing. And then what I would like to briefly do with respect to this bill before I turn it over to Mr. Tedesco is the Dash 1 Amendment. Simply all that does is that just aligns it with respect to the comparabilities for cities of 325,000 and counties of 400,000. Those similar issues would be for the West Coast only. And with that, I would like to turn it over to Mr. Tedesco to talk more specific as to what this particular piece of legislation is all about, and then I would go on to the other bills.
Thank you. Mr. Tedesco.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, what you have before you in these suggested alterations to the statute, I think, are modest changes. I have summarized in some detail with case citations and information that I believe has been passed out to you. Let me say this. The Senate Bill 750 changes, when they were made, a couple of them missed the mark by a wide shot, frankly, and I've done in many of these cases over the years. And arbitrators have specifically had a difficult time dealing with the concept of interest and welfare of the public as an abstract concept with absolutely no definition. So what the arbitrators have done is essentially looked at interest and welfare of the public and then defined it by what we're calling so-called secondary criteria, which comparability, CPI, issues such as that. So the hole in the statute has been filled in by arbitrators in the best way they knew how, and frankly there wasn't a whole lot of guidance in the law to do that. And so, arbitrators are not terribly comfortable doing that because, after all, they are spending public money, if you will, by making binding decisions. What this bill does is basically returns the interest and welfare of the public back to the ability to pay section of the statute, which makes, frankly, a lot of sense in terms of that's where it was. It made sense before, and frankly, since what's happened since 750, arbitrators have, in a lot of respects, just simply had to ignore. With respect to other problems with the bill, to point out, this would also broaden the jurisdictions to be compared with based upon not only overall compensation, but also looking at working conditions. I specifically had a problem involved with a group of firefighters who work at the Portland Air Base, at the Portland International Airport, because in the state of Oregon, they're state employees. We try to do comparability the way the statute suggests, which is strictly on the basis of population. The only problem is, if you work at the air base of Portland International Airport, there is no population. And it made it very difficult, frankly, to come up with a coherent argument, and my counterparts at the state, I think, had similar problems. Arbitrator Levac worked his way around it in a creative way, but the reality is there needs to be, that's a hole that needs to be filled here. And by saying working conditions, obviously we're filling that hole and giving some birth of argument to both sides. Finally, there's a hole in this statute with respect to CPI. Right now the statute says you look at the CPI cities, all cities index. The problem is there's two. There's the U and there's the I. It doesn't say which one. Also, that conflicts with the historical practice that many jurisdictions have had of looking at more localized CPIs. And if that's what their comfort has been over the years, then it seems to me that we should be able to fix that. That was an issue in an interest arbitration in Grants Pass, I might add, some years ago, back in 1997. I've got the citations for the arbitrations that I've cited here if you want to look at them. I think the legislative change that we're suggesting here is modest and is not intended to disrupt the essential changes that Senate Bill 750 imposed, which is final offer arbitration.
Mr. Deska, before you move on, I notice in the line 32 of page 2 of Senate Bill 444 that you remove the reference to CPI-all index, all cities indexed, and you add the language average consumer prices for goods and services. Is that, just tell me again what you're getting at with that distinction, because I thought what you would have done is add an even more concise definition of the CPIs that exist now.
Well, you know, there's all, as you know, there's all sorts of CPIs, and then there's, I think, last count, at least six that you could look at. What we intended to do there was to give the parties, both parties, management and labor, the ability to fashion their own view of how that works.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if we could quickly move on to Senate Bill 445. This has to do with how you define an employee with respect to whether they're deemed to be...
Before you move on to that, you explain what the Dash 1 amendments do?
I'm sorry about that. Yes, I will, fine. Mr. Chair. Simply, the Dash 1 amendments is just what this would do is inline it in concert with what the state of Washington has with respect to... The city of Portland and counties of 400,000 currently can compare to outside jurisdictions outside of Oregon. What this would do is help add clarification and say that that should be along the West Coast versus someplace like, not to be negative towards Mississippi, but someplace like Mississippi or someplace where really there's no real significant comparison with respect to the West Coast.
Thank you. Go ahead. Any questions, folks? Okay.
Senate Bill 445, as I was beginning to mention in my quick talking there, and I apologize for that, Mr. Chair, is has to do with how an individual is defined with respect to being supervisory. And what I mean by supervisory is how they make a determination on whether an employee is going to be in a bargaining unit or not. Once again, one of the things in the net of the far-sweeping reforms of 750, it is my view that particularly public safety officers and particularly police and firefighters somewhat got caught up in the broad context of how they tried to redefine supervisory employees. And what this would do is bring it back to a more traditional issue of how ERB looks at when they make a determination of who is going to be a bargaining unit employee and who is not. And one of the problems with this is I know that people have suggested that simply, well, let's just define what the position is and go from there as far as how we're going to define whether a person's in the bargaining unit or not. The problem with that is there's a whole variety of how people define or label an employee. And let me give you an example. A fire captain in Medford may have the same and similar duties as a lieutenant in Tualatin Valley, but yet they define them differently. Conversely, a captain in a fire department who's in essence a team leader, is on the front lines, works as a crew, as a team member of an engine company, is different than what, let's say, a police lieutenant would be. And so to try to define it simply by what a rank is causes problems. And the intent behind this bill is not to broaden the expansion of the bargaining units, but to go back and look at a traditional form of what was in place prior to 1995. Because clearly, under the current statutes, while there hasn't been a rampant amount of clarifications with respect to fire departments, there have been some isolated incidents where they have used this to reduce the bargaining units, particularly in some of the smaller jurisdictions. We have seen a broader base issue on in the police side of the bill as far as who's defined as a supervisory employee. And one of the things that I have concerns with and that I think has happened is that, in essence, not only on the fire side, but on the police side, you've really two issues that are a concern. One, it's a safety issue from the standpoint that people that would be good fire lieutenants and captains and people that are team leaders have basically elected not to promote. Not all of them, but some of them have done that, because what happens is you no longer have the protection of a bargaining unit. And so what happens is those people that have to make sometimes very decisive and quick decisions on either the fire ground or from a decision that a police officer has to make, I would argue that a safety component has been dropped because of the fact that the pool of good qualified candidates sometimes elects not to promote simply just because they're going to be deemed to be supervisory and taken outside of the bargaining unit. Clearly, we think that does cause some concerns, not only for the safety of the firefighters, but just from a public policy standpoint, we think it needs to be changed. And the reality of it is unequivocally, I can say, is that the reality of it is when the bell rings, you know, there's not an issue of labor management. You do your job, but there are issues from consternations on whether an individual elects to promote or not, and this bill would help to codify those people that are team leaders or foremen, similar to what you would have on a construction site in the private business, would be allowed to still be in the bargaining unit and perform their job. So that's a brief overview of that. Hope you can read my testimony, and I'd turn it over really quick to Mr. Tedesco to follow up.
Before we proceed, please, I just want to make an announcement. I think what we'll do is put off 860 and 861. I think this discussion, given the number of witnesses, is going to last long enough that if you want to have an adequate airing of 860 and 861, it probably makes more sense to go ahead and put this off till next week. So for those of you that are here for that particular reason, you're free to go. Thanks. Go ahead, Mr. Testa.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. On this particular issue, what we're seeking to do is basically go back to the way it was. And the interesting thing was that when Senate Bill 750 passed, there was a great deal of concern on the part of firefighters that management was going to use this as a tool largely to take the position of fire captain, in some places fire lieutenant, out of the bargaining unit. That's happened in very, very few places. So what essentially we're trying to do here is to maintain what is the status quo in the fire service. The problem is that if one were to take the statutory changes in Senate Bill 750 and try to take out members of fire bargaining units, it might be a relatively easy thing to do. And that would be, frankly, against good policy for a couple of reasons. One is, these are paramilitary organizations, particularly in the rural communities. The fire chiefs have a great deal of power, and they don't necessarily delegate a great deal of that power because the organization's small. Essentially, in the small jurisdictions, you've got one or two fire stations that are manned. And the fire chief is, you know, the eyes and ears. He knows what's going on, and he's out there doing what he's supposed to be doing, disciplining people and whatnot. They don't delegate that much authority. Now, in the bigger jurisdictions, it gets a little more complex than that, and I would acknowledge that right up front. The point here is that there is no need in a paramilitary organization to put these sorts of restrictions on, which is what makes the paramilitary organizations different than general bargaining units, where there is far more delegation of authority. You know, if a battalion chief, like my friend on the left here, makes a mistake in terms of a delegation, somebody can get really hurt. With non-public safety, maybe a job doesn't get done, but nobody gets hurt. So this makes sense. It brings us back to where we were.
Thank you very much. Any questions, panel?
Just one, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator.
This does limit it to public safety officers, which would be police and fire.
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, what it does is it limits to those people that are strike-barred employees, which is your public safety officers. Currently, the bill would include corrections, firefighters, as well as police officers. So non-strike-barred employees.
And did you speak to the Dash 1 Amendment?
I can't speak to the Dash 1 amendments. I believe that there's going to be people that can speak more eloquent to those than I.
Just a comment on the Dash 1s is that that you could comment on is, was there any intention in the drafting of this legislation to include the Department of Corrections or those folks at all?
Mr. Chair, I'd be more comfortable to allow either Martin Taylor or Mary Botkin to address that.
Okay.
They're the ones that are going to be, once again, it's one of those issues like a captain in the Department of Corrections may be inherently different than what a captain is in the fire department, so I would be more comfortable if I'd allow them to speak to that.
That's fine, but your interest in this is what I'm trying to establish, that your interest was essentially, you're a firefighter. I mean, your interest is in dealing
with
benefits for the department.
It's to go back to those traditional bargaining units that were mostly in place prior to Senate Bill 750.
Okay, thank you. Senator, do you have any questions? Okay, thank you very much. I want to proceed to...
Yeah, and just very quickly, Senate Bill 446, let me give you a little bit of background on Senate Bill 446. What this simply does, it's, I believe, is to another modest change, is it would allow those individuals that are strike-barred employees to simply be able to address safety issues at the bargaining table. As some of you may be aware, under the current law, in order to discuss safety issues, employees must be able to show that the safety issue has a direct and substantial effect on the job safety of public employees. The problem with this language is that it is virtually impossible to show a substantial effect for on-the-job safety, which is preventative or proactive in nature. Therefore, under the current law, public safety employees are caught in a catch-22 regarding the discussion of safety issues. And what I mean by the catch-22 is that you must show a substantial effect and prove to you that it's going to cause harm or do something like that. The problem with that is, and it's almost something terrible has to happen, a tragedy must occur before you're truly able to discuss safety issues. And one of the things that we feel strongly about is that in the 21st century, and particularly after the events of 9/11, where things have changed dramatically here, in not only Oregon but throughout the United States, that at a minimum public safety officers should be able to simply discuss safety issues at the bargaining table. Clearly, we don't live in a society like we used to. For example, firefighters are not only firefighters anymore. They're going to be the frontline individuals on any type of homeland security issue that we unfortunately probably will face. And certainly police officers will have that same confrontation when it does exist. And some of these issues we're still trying to struggle with on how best we deal with these. And as the people that are out there that are going to have to be the ones that are on the front lines, and when the call comes, we think that we are ones that can give some very good insight to our employers on what is working, what safety equipment's not working, what those major issues are, and simply this would just allow us to talk about those, nothing more, nothing less. And we think that it's a fundamental right that in the public safety arena, if we're going to be protecting the public safety, we should have a right to not only address safety concerns for our own, but safety concerns for the citizens of Oregon and the United States. And if I could just briefly allow Mr. Tedesco to wrap up, and be happy to take any questions after that.
And are the dash ones yours?
I apologize, yeah. The dash ones is just, it was no fault of legislative council. It was more my fault on that. Simply the dash ones, all they do is make sure that it codifies that the only thing that we're asking with respect to an addition of mandatory subject to bargaining is the safety issues. As the draft is written without the dash one amendments, someone could make the argument that gum chewing and those kind of things could be a mandatory subject to bargaining. And it clearly was not our intent to have those type of issues be mandatory subjects of bargaining.
Thank you. Mr. Kuziska.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, once again, it strikes me as so fundamental and slightly irrational at this point that the people that we ask to put their lives on the line for their communities don't get to discuss their protection and their safety with their employer in a formalized way at the collective bargaining table. We in this state, within the last few months in Coos Bay, have seen three firefighters die. I sat through the debriefing that happened as a result of that fire. All sorts of issues came up about things that could have been done differently, equipment that could have worked better. And it just struck me as so odd that here we were talking about it after three people died, when the law wouldn't have allowed us to talk about it at the bargaining table. You can't ask someone to go in to a situation where they can lose their life and yet tell them they can't talk about things that can make their life safer. It just is irrational. Finally, I'd note that for the concern of the management folks on this issue, we're not talking about anything other than the ability to talk about it. If firefighters, for example, propose a particular piece of equipment that they need to do their job safely and it comes with a price tag, that price tag may come at the expense of some employee benefit that they want. You see, but that's a choice through collective bargaining that gets made. That's why we have it. As Bob said, we have to be proactive about this. It's no time to talk about employee safety, really, after three people have died when you could have talked about it before. Thank you.
I have one question, and that is, it's probably more reasonable to ask Bob this question. Can you just give us some examples of a safety issue that you might have bargained had 750 not prohibited that?
Mr. Chair, one issue that comes to my mind right now is that clearly one of the things that we have struggled with, and it's not unique to the New York City and the World Trade Center issue, is the inoperability of our radio communications. In fact, if we were to have an incident in this building, in the basement right now, when firefighters and police officers were to come into this building, there's going to be no portable radio communications in the basement of this. So that's just one of many examples of that. We think that, albeit it may not, as Mr. Tedesco noted, it may cost us in the long run, we think that being proactive and being able to discuss this with our employers is something that's appropriate. And as we deal with some of these huge paradigm shifts that public safety is going to take the burden in the 21st century, we feel it makes good public policy to be proactive in some of these issues.
And safety, staffing, would that be an issue?
Staffing is one of those issues that clearly we have rural communities in Oregon where there are only one firefighter at a station.
Mm-hmm.
But yet at the same time we have, as you know, in order to be successful, particularly in a fire situation, a combination of events need to happen simultaneously. And so, what we'd like to do with respect to that is that although there may be one person at that fire station, the entity may have three fire stations for a total of four firefighters that are on duty. Maybe a better way to do that, at least to have a discussion on, would be to combine those force where you could really do some of those simultaneous functions versus simply saying, hey, we've got one person over here, so that it gives a false sense of security to the community that, oh, well, I've got a fire station right here, when in fact there may be only one person there.
Okay. Senator Minnis?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I have a disagreement over the bill, and Mr. Livingston and I have spoken about it. I think that actually some of the issues relevant to safety are so fundamental that they ought to be statutorily defined. It seems rather silly to me that you would leave it up to the collective bargaining to try to decide whether or not you're going to have equipment like lights and sirens on your police car, for instance. And I'll bring up, dime up my own agency. The detective cars that we roll around in and do our investigations in have, for the most part, no lights, no siren, and in a lot of instances, no radios. So if you're like me, crossing the Morrison Bridge in the rain, and you come across an accident, as a sworn police officer, I have a duty and a responsibility to at least take some intervention. Occasionally, you actually, as you're rolling across, listening to your PacSat radio, you come across a robbery or a crime in progress, and you have a duty to be involved, but you also have to care for your own safety. So you stop your car, your Crown Victoria, that looks like a police car, but there are no lights, there are no sirens, there's nothing in the form of safety equipment. I think that's a fundamental problem. I don't think that should be left up to the Portland Police Association to have to collectively bargain with the city of Portland. I think that issues like road flares, things that I would consider a keen sense of the obvious, the city of Portland has, in the most recent past, begun to supply ballistic vests that are, you know, within certain standards of range and quality and so on and so forth. They've begun to supply weapons to officers as they come into their employment, and handcuffs and things like this. But there are some other pieces of equipment that they don't supply. So I just think that there are some of these things that are so obvious, and maybe not so much in firefighting. I'm not a firefighter. I've never been a firefighter. But some of it is just so obvious that I think we need to spend some time with the statutory definition of what public safety agency should by statute require, and then what should be delineated as left to collective bargaining. I think the issue of the radio quality and service is one that clearly you could not dictate by statute, but and would be rightly left up to collective bargaining. But I just I visited agencies and out of state investigations in Chicago, you know, where I look at the quality of the equipment that the Chicago Police Department has and the Illinois State Police, and marvel at the stuff that they have, and it amazes me, the disparity between agencies. So I just think Oregon at least is way behind on this issue.
Well, with all three of these bills, Senator, we've got a little a glitch in each one that we need to fix. So we won't be moving these today, but I think it would be helpful for Mr. Livingston to have a discussion with you about how we might.
Well, Mr. I did introduce a bill that did mandate certain equipment, and I did get that information from the Bureau of Labor and Industries from a particular committee that they have, but I didn't have the necessary knowledge of the firefighting field to do that. And so at least I'd like to have some discussion about that. I'm not opposed to this bill. I just think that there are some things that if we have to leave it up to collective bargaining, it could take forever. The Portland Police Association have been bargaining with the city of Portland since, I think, July of last year, and they still do not have a contract. So notwithstanding this collective bargaining issue and then last best offer, they're working without a contract. They're out on the front lines trying to keep order in the city. And, as far as I'm concerned, from a morale point of view for those officers out there, it's not a very fun place to be, and it's not a very fun place to work.
Yeah, I think Mr. Tedesco's remarks are right on, that it's incredulous that you can't bargain safety under 750. I mean, that just makes absolutely no sense. The other example is police staffing, you know, at certain levels, and again, that's just...
I can tell you some story, but I won't.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen. I think we've covered it, and appreciate your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and we would be more than happy to work with the chair as well as the vice chair, and hopefully we can get some agreement with respect to the safety and some of these other issues and get these bills moving.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Ken Armstrong, you want to do a couple at a time? You guys want to do it yourself?
Yeah, let's bring us all.
Okay. Kevin Campbell, John Powell, okay. Ken Jones. Actually, you know what I'd like to do? I hate to do this. I would like the corrections person to come up and give the explanation of the dash ones, and I would also like the corrections officer to come up and explain his concern as well. I'm sorry. Thank you guys for your indulgence.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I am Chris Couts, the Assistant Director for Human Resources at the Oregon Department of Corrections. In relationship to Senate Bill 445, which is the bill that I have concerns on today, page 4, lines 13 through 15, where the bill indicates that no public safety officer who merely assigns, transfers, or directs the work of employees, but who has no authority to impose economic discipline on those employees, may be considered supervisory, causes me concern. The reason is that the Oregon Department of Corrections, like most state agencies, operates under an appointing authority direction, in that there are only about 20 people in the Department of Corrections that are authorized to impose economic sanctions on staff. In the institutions, those folks are the superintendents. So when you take a look at this language, the way that I have interpreted it and have discussed with folks here in the room is that when you what this language would do would essentially take those folks that are in the lieutenant, captain, security manager, and assistant superintendents out of the definition of supervisory employees. And that would leave about one person in the institution that could be considered a management service in the public safety officer series. So I believe that's pretty straightforward as to what my concern would be right there. We have asked for the dash one amendments. My intent was to simply take the Department of Corrections out of the bill because we did not want to get into the management structure issues that this creates for us. I understand the concerns that have been raised, and I think Gary and Mary would like to talk about those. So if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you, Chris. Any questions? Seeing none. Gary, go ahead.
My name is Gary Harkins. I apologize for my voice. I have a bad cold. I'm also a sergeant at the Oregon State Penitentiary, and I'm also president of the Association of Oregon Corrections Employees. My concern with the Dash 1 Amendment is in Section 23, small a, on the last page. It says up here that if you assign or have the responsibility to direct them, that theoretically the DOC could pull people out of a bargaining unit. Currently in the Oregon Department of Corrections, sergeants, corporals, and officers assign and direct work. So if the department wanted to right now, they could pull us out of a bargaining unit. What bold B is, the new language, was a way to address that issue, to keep the sergeants and the corporals and the officers still in collective bargaining, that we would not have to worry about the department someday waking up and pulling us out. The Dash 1 Amendment, as I see it, goes back to allowing the department to pull the sergeants, the corporals, and the officers back out of collective bargaining if they wish. I think what has to happen is, instead of the definition of corrections officers, that maybe taking a look at the DPSST rule and maybe looking at, you know, supervisory certified, or taking a look at the rule to find a specific language to kind of get to where the department wants to go. But I also want to say that the captains and lieutenants themselves believe they need collective bargaining. Looking at what has happened with them over the years, they don't know what shift they're going to work tomorrow. There's a whole lot of benefits that they don't get, and so they do need collective bargaining. And they wanted to be here to let you know that they do want it. But again, there's some issues there that, well, that's why they're not here. But so I understand why the department wants what they want, but I think they go too far. It doesn't protect the staff that are already in a collective bargaining agreement.
We'll let you guys work together a little bit on that. Were you going
to? No, I was just going to say that's where I get off the train. I really don't agree that captains or lieutenants should be in a bargaining unit. Portland Police Commanding Officers Association is a bargaining unit. I don't agree that they ought to be. It seems there should be a clear line of distinction between persons in a collective bargaining agreement that are members of this, the union, and those that are management. And persons in management, I think, is a very different animal, so to speak. I know I probably write a lot of heat for saying what I just said, but that wouldn't be unusual.
Nothing worse than the anti-tourism stuff that you're doing. Ms. Bodkins, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mary Bodkin. For the record, I represent the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees. And I have a suggestion. I don't know what this language should say.
Ms. Bodkin, we're going to let you have a week to work out that suggestion.
And what I would like to suggest to the committee is that we keep Monica Smith on retainer. She does this all the time. She is our lawyer that takes care of unit clarifications and definitions, and she's with ERB. And you know what? I'm not. So my suggestion is that we have Monica Smith talk to Legislative Council and let them work out the words on paper so that we get where we need to be. And then we bring it to the committee. And we can either bring it to this committee or we can bring it to the House committee. If we take it to the House committee, you know, I have no interest in slowing this bill down for the firefighters. That's not my issue. But I think that it would be helpful if somebody, maybe you, Mr. Chair, or a member of the committee, came over with us and said that we had kind of said this, that we're going to fix it over there.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of fixing things. I just soon get it done right the first time. I don't know how you feel about that.
I'm trying to figure out, Mr. Chairman, if there's a distinction, you know, that we can make between those persons that are currently in collective bargaining agreements so that there's not a subsequent transition.
We're not. It is not my intent to overstep the bounds that we currently have.
Right.
And Mr. Chair and members of the committee, it is not the department's intent either. Okay. We just want to keep, for the Department of Corrections, the lines that we currently have.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think that one place it might affect, and I don't know if the state police are present today, but I know that when Senate Bill 750 passed, their sergeants were moved out of the bargaining unit. I think, frankly, that was detrimental policy for the Department of State Police because a lot of folks had experience with the Department of State Police knew what was coming, and those persons on the sergeant's list who had experience didn't take the promotion.
Right.
And those who were young and dumb took it and, you know, changed the composition of how the organization functioned. So I think that was very, very problematic. But in one sense, I'd like to be able to force the sergeants in the Oregon State Police back into the bargaining unit. On the other hand, that may be more complex than just trying to hold everybody harmless where we're at now.
Yeah, as Mr. Livingston said, you know, it also changes people's interest in promotions and such, so it does have a real structural effect.
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, I'd be happy to run the language past Mr. Botwins with the State Police Officers Association.
So I just have a process question, Senator. Because this is on record, this request to have have some staff work with the Legislative Council. They won't need a note from other or anything. It's just pretty...
No, I think you just direct your council here.
Okay.
Staff to work with them, and they do.
Consider yourself so directed. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, gentlemen. Sorry. Thank you for your indulgence. I wanted to just kind of get that sequentially done so we could...
These guys are probably feeling like they're going up against the front lines in Portland now.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police. I was just going to say, the earlier hearing when we saw the new video technology, he looked like an embedded reporter, didn't he? That was very interesting. At any rate, we have made a decision to draw straws so that only one of us is presenting an official position from the three organizations we've been together. I will say, I won't be the one because I didn't draw the short straw. But I will say that one of the nice
short jokes in this committee.
I apologize, Mr. Chair. That was a wrong direction that I will pay for.
Just don't do it.
I will say that one of the nice things about this session is that Mr. Livingston, police officer associations, and the groups assembled here, we have some common obstacles this session and some common challenges, and we're working together on a lot of things. So this is a unique circumstance that we're coming to the table today to oppose some bills. But we continue to look forward to working with them in a process to discuss something that we'll be able to do together. With that, I'm going to turn it over to John Powell and then Ken Armstrong. We do have some practitioners, some folks that are in the midst of this work. They're probably the more important ones for you to hear from, but we thought we would get our stuff out of the way quickly.
Mr. Chairman, I'm just going to put my name and affiliation on the records. John Powell, representing the Oregon State Sheriff's Association.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Ken Armstrong here today representing the Oregon Fire Chiefs Association. I've distributed to you a letter jointly signed by the Chiefs of Police, by the Sheriff's Association, and by the Fire Chiefs. And I think it outlines for you pretty well where we are. I'm not going to read it. You can read that at your own leisure. But the short message in our testimony is this. I'm concerned that we are where we're at today with respect to these three bills. And the reason for that is simple. As you can tell by the previous testimony, these are some terribly complex issues. And we are concerned about opening up essentially Senate Bill 750 without a broader process of dialogue. Now, lest we be accused of, oh, there's the employers knee-jerk reacting, going against what the employees are proposing, let me assure you that's not the case. As Kevin has suggested, we're working very closely with labor interests on a lot of issues this session. But relative to collective bargaining, we've got some concerns. We think that a process needs to take place that if, in fact, there are some concerns on the labor side, some issues that need to be discussed, those need to be discussed with the labor side. With the employer side, excuse me. We have not been approached on these issues during the interim, where we might have had an opportunity to work with some of those folks on the specific issues and to address whether we've got some real problems or some perceived problems. That would be the time to do that. We would like to enter into that kind of a process. We have no problem with having that sort of discussion. Is that a discussion that can take place in a week in the midst of this current session? I doubt it. Is this something that we would like to take up during this next interim? Perhaps that's a more appropriate process. But I think where we're at today with these bills and with the uncertainty of what the implications of some of these are going to be, I think it's the wrong time to move these forward. In response to some of the comments about the safety issues as being part of collective bargaining, I want to take to a degree some exception to that. From the fire chief standpoint, I know my colleagues here with the fire chief, with the police chiefs and with the sheriffs would agree. We put nothing first ahead of the safety of our employees, top to bottom. That's the number one issue for us, and I'm not so sure that's an issue that needs to be part of the collective bargaining process. But if there are some things that we need to talk about, let's talk about those issues. That process has not taken place. That's why we're here opposing these bills. And so with that, we've got a couple of our legal folks that are able to address some of the specifics that were brought up both during the previous testimony, and also if you want to get into a more detailed discussion on the bills, they can do that. Our intent was not to come in and line by line, you know, express our opposition and our problems, but generally to say this is not where we should be right now. We should be in a different part of the process. And with that, I'm more than happy, of course, to answer questions, and we also have a couple of our erudite legal counsels here to visit about some of those issues.
Thank you. Henry Drummond wears a ballistic vest around me whenever he sees me, because I always remind him of my absolute love for 750. And I guess the one thing I would like you to do is, and this, I had no dog in this fight. I don't represent law enforcement folks per se. So this is something I observed from, as just, you know, from the labor community, is just watching this go on with 750. How do you address this issue of safety not being negotiable? I really have a hard time getting my hands around that.
Mr. Chair, again, Ken Armstrong, I think it's a hard one to get your arms around. I think it's an important issue, and I think that's the classic example of all the issues that we're looking at in these three bills. That would be the classic example of something that needs to be talked about so we can determine, okay, what is the problem that we're trying to isolate and identify, and then what are some ways to get at that? Are there some ways other than dealing with it through collective bargaining? Probably so. The other side may say, absolutely, that's the only way we can deal with it, but I think by getting together and talking about those, that's a way to start chipping away at it. But in a straight answer to your question, I'm not sure.
Okay, thanks. Thank you, gentlemen. Welcome.
Thank you. Senators, my name is Ken Jones. I'm an attorney representing the Oregon Fire District Directors Association. In my private practice, I represent approximately 80 units of local government throughout the state of Oregon. My expertise is not necessarily in labor law. We've got the guy next to me who does that every day. But my expertise is in trying to decide what the impacts are in terms of legislation and how it's going to impact our clients, because many, many pieces of legislation have many unintended consequences. And with that, I would like to walk through some of the changes that are made here. And again, specifically, we're not trying to do a line-by-line walkthrough and talk about the problems, but I want to bring up just some of the issues that the bills raise. First of all, with Senate Bill 444. In Senate Bill 444, it moves the interest and welfare of the public and the reasonable financial ability of the unit of government to meet the costs of the proposed contract down the priority list. That takes it out of what an arbitrator ought to be thinking about. I don't think the public interest ought to be anything other than first. But more importantly, what this does, it eliminates the arbitrator's ability, which is in the current law, to give due consideration and weight to the other services provided by and other priorities of the unit of government as determined by the governing body. You're eliminating the flexibility of a governing body of elected officials to make those calls. You're eliminating their ability to decide what's important for their community in terms of how they spend their dollars.
Mr. Chair.
And that's what this does.
Senator Minnis?
I have to tell you, Mr. Jones, I have absolutely no problem with that.
That's just fine, sir.
I think,
but I'll tell you that
I think the city I work for makes some very poor choices in terms of where they put their money.
And I would bet that your organization supports candidates, and I'll bet your organization spends money for those candidates, and I think that's the process that all of us are here with. I can debate political philosophy with you, but I think it's negative.
Mr. Jones, right here, this is the legislature, now city. Mm-hmm. And we are the persons empowered to make this choice.
And so your knowledge of what goes on in terms of a small fire department in eastern Oregon is better than the people that live there in determining the level of service that they receive?
I think in a theoretical approach to government, yes. The legislature, in fact, does have a greater power and a greater authority than local governments.
Is it fair if I just simply disagree from a political philosophy basis?
You can do whatever you want, sir.
Thank you. Obviously, I'm not getting off on a very good start once we move off of the issues in hand and we move into political philosophy. Political philosophy I could discuss all day with anyone that cares to.
Senator Minnis and I already do that.
The point is, I still think the point is that local control, you're taking away the ability for a city to say, in our city, parks are more important than looking at the number of firefighters and having an arbitrator tell me that instead of paying for 6 firefighters, I'm now going to pay for 10 firefighters, and I'm now not going to be able to have a park. And I think that's the point that this gets down to when you start putting all of these together. And I don't, that's the issue. These are not minor changes. These are major changes in philosophy in terms of collective bargaining. People spent hours, days, years working out compromises to arrive at Senate Bill 750. These are not minor changes.
Mr. Chairman, actually, I'd like to ask that this gentleman's remarks be transcribed for the floor speech.
Okay. Heather, note that we can talk.
I think you had a very best argument in favor of these bills.
Yeah, I think you're kind of digging a deeper hole for yourself, but go ahead.
I think since I've already dug a hole according to this committee, that proceeding further with my comments about the need for local control, the need for communities to be able to have their control over their areas, I'm obviously not going to move anything forward with this committee, and so I think probably it'd be best for me to relinquish the floor to the gentleman to my left.
Right. I mean, 750, you know, that kind of gets my goat, because there was no negotiation over 750. That was just a done deal. It was done to the workers. So we all have our differences. I don't know that it makes more sense in terms of the safety of a firefighter or a police officer to not have the ability to discuss the importance of a park over a safety issue is logical to me at all. Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Ken Bemis. I'm with the law firm of Bullard, Smith, Jernstead, Wilson in Portland. And we represent management exclusively in labor and employment issues. I've been in practice for over 13 years, almost 14, and devote my entire practice to collective bargaining, representing public sector agencies predominantly in my practice throughout the state of Oregon. I'm not going to get into a political debate. I would like to point out some of my concerns with these bills as they're drafted. Let me start with Senate Bill 444, which tries to modify the interest arbitration criteria. I agree with Mr. Jones that interest and welfare of the public should be first. And I think the arbitrators, even though they've tended to emasculate that criterion and probably give it a different tenor than was maybe intended or originally anticipated, it still actually works pretty well. Because it forces an arbitrator to take each of these criterion and make sure that they fit within what is in the interest and welfare of the public. It doesn't mandate that one override another, but it certainly requires them to reach a logical conclusion.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator.
I've got to ask this question, because before we had the last best offer methodology, I think what you're saying was right. The arbiter could then choose, pick and choose, based on the issues that were presented in collective bargaining. But that's not the environment within which we live today. We have last best offer. Management submits an offer, labor submits an offer, and the arbiter has no choice but one or the other. And that is a very different thing.
I still think that the arbitrator is required to put that decision in the context of what is in the best interest and welfare of the public. The interesting thing is, if you look at the interest arbitrations that have come down, there's been, I counted, 61 to date. There isn't an imbalance in the decisions going management versus labor. It's almost split right down the middle. If there was an imbalance, I would be concerned that the process isn't working. But the process is working. I've lost many. I've won many. And I'm sure Mr. Tedesco and other practitioners would be able to say the same thing. But the process actually works very well. It gets the parties to talk very seriously from the very outset of negotiations. And I, in my own personal experiences, I've seen a tremendous improvement in the sincerity of discussion from the outset of bargaining, which did not exist prior to Senate Bill 750. Prior to Senate Bill 750, a group, a union, a management, whatever, they would have no disincentive not to throw up 30 issues to try and get five to stick. There's a penalty for doing that now if you're too outrageous in your demands.
But Mr. Bemis, it kind of begs the question that if these aren't mandatory subjects of bargaining because of 750, wouldn't that have an impact as well on what you're able to put in as an offer?
Well, speaking to Senate Bill 446, which is, I think, what you're referring to on safety,
actually just speaking to your general comment that somehow the bargaining was more sincere now. That strikes me that the bargaining is more controlled now, but I don't know if that increases sincerity. If you eliminate something as important as safety from consideration, it probably does make for a smaller table.
Maybe I'll jump to 446 to maybe highlight a response. The way that the present language reads that Senate Bill 750 put into place didn't remove safety from bargaining. It removed it from bargaining only to the extent that it didn't have a direct and substantial effect on the on-the-job safety of public employees. I might have said that backwards. If the subject has a direct and substantial effect on the on-the-job safety of public employees, it's bargainable. And I'll give you an example of how that has actually worked. I can guarantee you, at least with my clients that I work with, that they don't treat that lightly. That's a pretty nebulous standard. And it is a built-in balancing test when it comes to safety and workload. And that's the way I analyze it with my clients, because it's not clear-cut. I had an issue with a city where the city wanted to standardize going to Glock 40s. There were a number of managerial benefits to having everybody using the same guns, same firearms, same training. And it could be viewed, it could be argued that balance tipped in favor of management. But the union presented some very good arguments that led to officer training, qualification, individuals. One individual had a disability issue that precluded him from using a standard Glock 40. And we approached that issue by getting to the table and bargaining. In my line of work, I don't tell a client, oh, you don't have to bargain about that, just do it. I mean, if there's a gray area, we're at the table. And maybe on paper it looks different, but in reality, the grayness of this standard that presently exists forces parties to the table. And that's been my experience. So I don't see the existing law is removing safety from bargaining whatsoever. If it has a direct and substantial effect on the on-the-job safety of public employees, we have to bargain about it. And we do. The other problem with that is if you say that any safety or any workload issue becomes mandatorily bargainable, there are some issues which are purely managerial prerogative, and you then turn those over to a third party who, again, I have to agree with Mr. Jones, that an arbitrator does not have accountability to the electorate. The persons making those decisions for each agency do, and they can get elected and replaced if they make the wrong decisions. But an arbitrator doesn't have that. And there are a number of arbitrators out there that, from my own personal opinion, make wrong decisions. And those wrong decisions should not lie with somebody who doesn't have accountability to the public.
I guess, though, sir, that the point should be made that they're often selected on the basis of results that you just described. They split the baby. They can't split the baby anymore because of last offer, but they split it in terms of decisions to one side or the other.
I don't see a splitting of the baby. I think that would be an unfair characterization of what happens. I mean, I don't think they say management won one, therefore I'm going to give labor this one under the present law. I think they...
Gee, I just haven't seen many management decisions to allow for an arbitrator in the selection that has made all their decisions in favor of the union. And conversely is, the same case. Unions don't pick arbitrators that just side with, it's just that's the nature of the business,
sure.
I think.
With regard to, I'll jump back to the interesting, the 444 bill. I think there's some subtleties that we have to be very careful with. Beyond the interest and welfare of the public, I have some concerns, as did Mr. Jones, about not giving consideration to the weight of other services and priorities. It didn't say you have to give them absolute primary consideration. It just says give them consideration. And I don't see the danger of leaving that language in there. Giving due consideration and weight to the other services provided by another priorities of the unit of government as determined by the governing body. There isn't an arbitrator out there that I've run across that hasn't looked at that, given it consideration, and ruled against the governing body. This present language does not preclude them from doing that. All it requires them to do is give consideration to it. And they do. Sometimes they agree with management, sometimes they don't. But they do give consideration, and that's all the present language provides for. I really don't see the advantage of getting rid of it, and I see a danger of doing so. In terms of eliminating the ability and unit of the unit of government to attract and retain qualified personnel, I've experienced cases where that has been a detriment and a positive factor. I don't think you can ignore it. It is actually a factor that was considered probably in the umbrella factors in the old law prior to Senate Bill 750. We would argue that all the time, and so would the unions if it was an issue. I don't know if I agree with removing it, because I think it is an important enough issue, and it does impact what should be considered. If you have an agency that has ample supply of labor, and I have clients on both ends of the spectrum. I have small departments I represent that have a horrible time trying to attract people. They lose them to the bigger departments that provide, you know, an easy and better benefit base. I have the same issue with big clients who have a tremendous pool, people dying to get in there. Obviously, the market forces are working to dictate that situation, and arbitrators have given great credence to that. A number of decisions recently have relied on that factor to determine the outcome. And I wouldn't get rid of it. I think it's an important factor. I have minor concerns over the change in terminology, getting away from overall compensation and listing wages, hours, and conditions of employment. I think that gets away from what an arbitrator truly is to look to. Wages, hours, and conditions of employment really doesn't include benefits, and you need to look at benefits. You need to look at some other things beyond just wages, beyond just hours, and beyond just conditions of employment. I think overall compensation does a better job, and maybe there's some wordsmithing that can perchance improve that criterion, but I'm concerned about the way it's presently phrased. Those are my main concerns. Again, I don't want to line item these, but I think these changes need considerable attention. I think they could have very dramatic impacts if we don't take into account each of those changes and how they might affect the outcome. Each of them tend to provide special privileges for law enforcement and for public safety in general. And I'm the first one to put my gratitude on the line for the people out there in the streets that defend us and that save us and that provide us a safe environment to live in. But at the same time, the chiefs, the sheriffs, the supervisory command staff need to be able to make decisions and need to be able to do things when those lives are on the line. And when these things are held up in bargaining or managerial prerogatives are turned over to the bargaining process, that's a potential for disaster. And I don't think we want to bog down in a bureaucracy over things that are generally perceived as managerial prerogative.
Thank you. Any questions?
Gentlemen, just briefly, if I may. I'd like to apologize to Senator Corcoran and Senator Menace. I'm sorry this got down to a personal level. Certainly that my views in this case certainly don't represent the views of my client, and I certainly wouldn't want those to spill over, and I apologize to both of you for that.
No problem. Mr. Jones, I get a little bit passionate from time to time, too, so it's kind of part of the process. I think I've lost my client. I look at companies in Oregon like ADEC. ADEC is a non-union company whose owners take an interest in their employees, and they provide a benefit package that is extraordinary compared to other companies similarly situated. They don't want a union or need a union or care about collective bargaining because the people that own the company care about their employees, and they have long-term employees. I happen to work for a city that I think their attitude is hostile towards the police department and towards public safety. And would rather build parks and build caps over freeways and baseball parks and a bunch of other things to the detriment, I think, in a long-term interest of the citizens of that state. Now, I happen to disagree with the city council there. But you see, if you don't have the chance to bargain these things, then you never have a chance to speak up. And that's the issue. You suppress their ability to speak out on these issues. It becomes irrelevant, as it is in the city of Portland. We've been almost a year now trying to collectively bargain. Trust me, my union doesn't like me necessarily because I voted against their issues from time to time, too. But I'm telling you my experience in the organization that I work for. When you shut people out, you shut their ability to speak out, I think you create a problem. I would rather repeal 750 and
It's in totality. We're back to where we were before. So all of the issues are on the table. Fundamentally and philosophically, I think the collective bargaining process is there to come to a mutual agreement between an employer and an employee. And legislatively, we shouldn't be setting up one advantage over the other. I think all of these issues should be on the table. But likewise, I don't think employers should run over the top of their employees either. And it goes the other way. I don't think the employees should run over their employer or not show up for work or not produce. But, you know, we find ourselves in these things because I guess my experience and why I guess I have to take the position that I do is my experience is such that I think your position is totally wrong. I think that the unions should have the ability to put these things on because I've seen it firsthand. That's my experience.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Okay, is there anybody else wishing to testify? Yes, you're raising your hand there, young man.
My name again is Gary Harkins, and I'm president of the Association of Foreign Corrections Employees. I'd like to comment on 444. We're in full support of 444. We think it's needed. And one of the things that we have found, I have done probably a dozen interest arbs, and I've won under pre-750, I've won post-750, and I've even settled without interest arb. So I've gone the whole gamut. What I find is the arbitrators have a difficult understanding of just what the interest and the welfare of the public means. They grapple over that. What does it mean? And we get into big arguments and discussions. So there's a lot of confusion about that. Regarding the Dash 1 Amendment, I do have a clarifying question about what is meant by the West Coast, because sometimes we use Idaho and Nevada and some other states, and so I was just kind of curious as to whether it was strictly Washington, Oregon, California, or if it did include Idaho and Nevada and sometimes Montana.
What we'll probably do when we move these in work session is ask the drafters of that amendment to elaborate on what their intent was.
Thank you. Regarding 446, it's very imperative to us that we have the ability to bargain over safety and staffing. I have an officer who is going to be disciplined because he broke a fight up by himself. The safety officer said that at the minimum of that fight there should have been four staff. There was no backup available. He went in based on his police training, not his corrections training. He broke up the fight. There was minimal injuries. And he was just fortunate that he didn't get hurt. We would love to have pepper spray in our institutions on most of the staff. We can't get there. We are concerned that sometime they ever want to take our handcuffs away. You know, they could do that. And we don't want to get there either. We want to bargain staffing. For instance, we had an office. We had a person who was supervising 10 inmates on an outside work crew on the grounds of the penitentiary. They took that position and the funding for that position, put 10 inmates with the other staff member who was supervising 10 inmates, so he's now watching 20, and they used the funding for that to pay for out-of-class and pay raises for two management secretaries. We see over 400 vacant positions in the DOC. We need our line staff. Those positions are being held for budgetary issues and other things. And we need that staff. You know, an officer should be able to have pepper spray, for instance, instead of getting broken ribs in a fight, which happened to one of our sergeants in a bar.
But your point here is that you need the ability to bargain.
We need to do that. And again, the things that we bargain with, the asbestos issues and things like that, we find that Oregon OSHA is not willing to come in and deal with the issues adequately on the state level. So, again, we are in support of 446, 445, and 444. Thank you
very much. I think we'll call it a day. Thank you for your indulgence, panel, and we're adjourned.